After my parents got a divorce, my sister and I took a trip to California to visit our family. And I was on the phone with my dad. I was kind of in a rush and just told him, hey, dad, could I call you later tonight? And he said, yeah, sure, no problem. Yeah, just give me a call later. I love you too, goodbye. Came back and it was late. So I just thought, I'll call him tomorrow. The next day I woke up, gave him a call, rang, went to voicemail. My sister and I start talking about, this is so weird. Like, how come dad hasn't responded to us? And it was actually becoming, scary. My grandma enters the room and she's crying. So we already knew. I was just sitting there on the couch, just in disbelief. I'm never gonna speak to him again. I'm never gonna see him again. Who's gonna teach me how to drive? Who's gonna teach me how to shave? Who's gonna give me really lame girl advice? It was draining on my soul, just not being able to think about anything else but the loss. From the outside looking in, you wouldn't be able to tell. You'd see Dylan and, of course, yeah, he was dealing with some stuff and he was sad, but he was still Dylan. He was still had a smile on his face. But behind closed doors, it was consuming me.
We're going to hear the rest of Dylan's story a little bit later. But welcome, guys, for you that are here at Next Level. My name's Clay. I'm one of the pastors here. We're thrilled that you are here. And if you're a guest with us today, it's a good time to be here because we are going through who we are as a church. And so we began this series a couple of weeks ago. And with the hurricane that came through, we didn't meet last week. So we began a series where we're saying, who is it that we are? Why do we do what we do? And to kind of recap a little bit of that, we said that every organization has a driving force behind it. Every organization has something that moves it and drives it. And that can be a business organization, it can be a community organization, it can be a church. Not every organization knows why they do. The best organizations know why they do what they do. But everybody does something. And when it comes to churches, there is driving forces behind churches. And maybe you grew up in churches that were kind of had the tradition as the driving force. You know, we've always done it that way, and this is just the way it's done, and my dad did it this way, and my granddad did it this way. And so all of their framework and what drives them is this idea of tradition. There are churches that are driven by personality. Hey, our pastor is this person, and so that kind of drives what they do. There are churches that are driven by programs. And so they, like, we have music, and so we're just known as music, and that drives everything that they do. Or like we talked about last Sunday, you have the singing Christmas tree every year that nobody comes to, but you do it every year, and it's just who you are. Or maybe there are churches that are driven by their buildings, and their identity is found in their buildings. Every church has something that moves it and drives it. So what we wanted to do in this series was taught to you guys about what moves us and drives us as a church. We've been going through, the last 12 months has been a crazy growth period for us. And so there's a lot of people here that you weren't here the last time that we talked about why we do what we do. You've experienced it. And so what we wanted to do was take some time during the fall to say, this is our mission. These are the things that drive us. This is what is behind why we do what we do. And so we began 2 weeks ago with kind of an underlying talk that you'll hear us say a lot here. Your story is safe here. Pastor Joseph mentioned it when he was out here earlier, that there is this underlying thing that this is a no judgment zone, that we understand very clearly that Jesus said, look, that person may have a speck in their eye, but you have a plank in your own eye. We get it. Not that anybody's perfect, not that you don't need to change, but we need to change too. And so we will lock arms with you. We will journey with you no matter where you're at. Even if you don't believe what we believe, you can belong here. And that kind of is a baseline for who we do. So what I want to spend the next 3 weeks on, though, is really the mission that we have been called to. If that's our base and our foundation, then what is the mission that Jesus has put in front of us? And maybe when you were checking out the church, you read the mission statement, maybe you didn't, but we take this very, very seriously. So I'm going to put it on the screen for us, and it's simply this. What is our mission? We're basically called to do three things. To be a community of people who grow in the freedom that Jesus offers, And that's discipleship. So we're going to grow in our relationship with Jesus. We're going to grow in the freedom, because I believe as you grow in your relationship with Jesus, you experience more freedom. Grow in the freedom that Jesus offered, loves everyone radically and unconditionally. This is this idea of community, creating this crazy community that Pastor Joseph talked about. And then we want to be a people who raise the reputation of Jesus where we live, work, and play. That for us is evangelism. So discipleship, community, and evangelism, that's what we do. We do three things, and we turn off lights. Yeah, there we go. This is all fun. I don't get shaken easy. That's good. We do three things around this place. We do discipleship, we do community, and we do evangelism. We make no bones that this is a really, really simple church. We don't try to do a whole lot of extra stuff, and we fit everything that we do into that framework and into those buckets. So over the next 3 weeks, I really want to just talk to you about those three aspects of why we do what we do, and talk about how maybe we do them a little bit uniquely, because, guys, there's nothing new. It's not like we invented discipleship, community, and evangelism. Probably every church that you encounter out there has as a part of their mission, whatever, we want to do discipleship, community, and evangelism. What we believe, how we do it and how we go about it is why God is blessing us where we're at, because we're doing it exactly the way that he called us to do. So let me go through, and we're going to talk about the first aspect. We're going to talk about discipleship, this idea that we are growing in the freedom that Jesus offers. In almost every area of our life that is important to us, we have some sort of mechanism that shows us accurately where we're at and kind of allows us to measure up to where we're at so we can get an accurate picture of who we are. One of the things, as I was thinking about this, that we all have, I don't think any of us do not have a mirror in your home, right? You have a mirror, because all of us, even if you say you don't, to some degree, you do care about how you look. And guys, if you don't care how you look when you go out of the house, your wife cares about how you look when you go out of the house. And so we have some way to accurately look at. And so the interesting thing about a mirror is you can come up to a mirror, and when you look into a mirror, it is going to accurately show you what your face is like, what your body is like. This is accurate. Like, I can have a picture in my head of what I'm like. Like, I am so much cooler online. But when I look in the mirror, this is it, right? And so the bad thing for guys when it comes to mirrors is this. Like, when a guy looks in the mirror, he looks and says, that's as good as it's going to get, right? Ladies, you guys have stuff. You have concealer, you've got makeup, you can make your eyes look better. When a guy looks in a mirror, this is it. This is what we're going to go with. And the sad reality when we look into a mirror is the realization of, I once looked better, and the picture I'm looking at right now is as good as it's going to get into the future. It only gets worse from here. Right? But we all have this, and the reason we have a mirror, because a mirror does not lie. A mirror tells you exactly where you're at. So we have other things. If you care about weight and you care about how you're doing physically, you have a scale, right? And you step on that scale, and the scale tells you. Now, people, I get it. We do all kinds of funky things before we step on a scale. We strip down completely naked. We take out contact lenses, and we exhale before we get on the scale, right? But that scale gives us, no matter what we think, no matter how, you know, I'm thinking I'm feeling good, you know, and that chocolate cake didn't affect me, you can step on the scale, and the scale's not going to lie to you. It's going to give you an accurate picture of where you're at. Now, beyond that, if you're here and you're in school, if you go to school, and, you know, college, high school, it doesn't really matter, you get something every quarter and then every semester that gives you an accurate picture of where you're at, right? It's called a report card. You get a report card, and the report card says, academically, this is where you're at. As you get a little bit older, you get some things like bank statements, and you get your bank statement. Your bank statement says, you suck at finances, right? And it gives you an accurate picture of where you're at. And then you grow even beyond. Kids, you're like, man, I can't wait to get away from report cards. You don't. You go to work, you get another thing. We don't call them report cards. We call them performance reviews. And basically, it's where you get to sit across from your manager that you don't like and you don't get along with, and he gets to tell you how awful of an employee you actually might be, and you get a report card, and you're raised. Money's based on it now, right? In every area of our life that seems to be important, we have some way to be able to measure where we are at. But in this area that I think is the most important area of our life, when it comes to how am I doing spiritually, most people, and when I say most, I mean the huge majority of people, they don't have something to measure how they're doing spiritually. And so I can be around someone who is just really, really anal with their money. I mean, they watch every nickel. I can be with someone who is really, really, really uptight about how they handle, you know, their physical fitness and what they eat and how that goes. I can, someone academically is just, all they're so worried about what their grades are and where they're going to go to college and what major am I going to get a scholarship. I can talk to all of these people who have measurements. But then when I say, well, how are you doing spiritually, really? How do you measure up? What I get back is, I don't know. Or a lot of vagueness. I guess I'm doing okay. I don't really see, but this is the most important area of our life that we should be able to measure how we're doing. And fortunately, there is a way that we can measure how we are doing spiritually. Now, when I went to seminary, you go to seminary, they teach you a lot of things, but one of the things that they primarily teach you, because them it is of utmost importance for them to teach you, is how to teach the Bible. We're going to teach you how to teach the Bible. And what the driving force, and that's good to be able to do, but the driving force behind why, at least in my school and schools my friends went to, the reason they teach you that is because in school, in seminary, they equate spiritual maturity with biblical knowledge. That if you can just know more Bible, then you will be more spiritual. This even happens in Christian circles. This happens in churches. It happens in the church that I grew up with. That if you just know a whole lot of Bible, then you should be and you will be spiritually mature. That in order to be spiritually mature, that means you need to have more biblical knowledge. Now, the problem with that thinking, and knowing the Bible is not bad. Don't ever, you should know the Bible. But the problem with thinking that more knowledge equals spiritual maturity, the problem with that is that's not how Jesus viewed spiritual maturity at all. In fact, the people that Jesus had the biggest problems with, the people that Jesus encountered and went head-to-head with, were some of the most biblically scriptured literate people of their time. He was dealing with people that had not just a couple of verses memorized. Imagine this. All of the rabbis that he went to, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, every single one of them had every single word of the Old Testament memorized. Every word. Yet these are the people that Jesus had the biggest problem with. See, for Jesus, spiritual maturity is not about what you know. It's about how much you love. That this determines spiritual maturity. It had very little with knowledge, and spiritual maturity for Jesus had everything to do with action, taking action. It shows up all through the New Testament. I just pulled one instance out for us to look at, but this is how Jesus thinks about knowing and action and different things. So in Luke chapter 6, he begins to say this. He said, I will show you what it's like when someone comes to me, listens to my teachings, and follows it. So in other words, someone who took some action. This is what it's like. It's like a person building a house who digs deep and lays the foundation on solid rock. When the floodwaters rise and break against that house, it stands firm because it's well built. But anyone who hears and doesn't obey, right? They don't obey, is like a person who builds a house right on the ground without a foundation. And when floods sweep down against that house, it will collapse into a heap of ruins. Two groups of people that Jesus is talking about here. One group of people, they hear what Jesus is saying. They take in the knowledge, and then they do what he says. The other group of people, they hear the exact same thing. They get the exact same knowledge, and they choose not to do anything about it. Jesus says, one's going to be able to stand, and one is going to collapse. One takes action. One does not take action. You see, when Jesus promises a life, when he says, look, I came to give you life, life to the full, abundant life. If you do not do what he says, you cannot claim that as a promise. Because he says, look, it's like the person who hears what I said and just builds their house right there on the ground. And when life comes, and life will come, and when trouble comes, and trouble will come, it will wipe out your life. You have to do what Jesus said. And so the gospel, the good news of Jesus, what Jesus talks about, the gospel, I put it in your notes this way, does not call for reflection. The gospel calls for action. That is not we want to sit and contemplate the teachings of Jesus. And that's great. I mean, I get with my friends and we like to think deep. At least we think we like to think deep. And if you want to go have a cigar and talk about the deep teachings, I can do that with you. But that is not spiritual growth. The gospel is about taking action. The gospel is about doing what Jesus said. Jesus didn't come to dispense information. And very rarely do we ever find Jesus chastising somebody because they lacked knowledge. No, it just doesn't take place. What he chastised people for is lack of application. When he's out on the boat and he told the disciples, hey, get in the boat, we're going to go to the other side of the lake. And they go on the trip, it's in the middle of the night, Jesus is down below, it says, taking a nap. Storm comes, big waves, wind, disciples are freaking out. You remember, and Jesus comes up, he calms the storm, and then he says to them, oh, guys, why is your faith so small? What he is chastising them for is like, I said we were going to the other side of the lake. Why don't you just believe? Why don't you just take action in what I said? He doesn't say, guys, gosh, your faith is just so small. What you need is more Bible study. It's not what he's saying. He's saying take action. This is what he gets upset about. So it's not about knowledge. It's about application. It's not about just hearing what Jesus says. It's about doing what Jesus says. And so Jesus comes along and he says some radical things that if you're going to follow Jesus, he asks us to do some things that don't make sense, some radical, crazy things. He said, if you're going to follow me, you're going to love your enemies. Yeah, that person that you think is totally against you, they probably are totally against you. You're going to love them anyway. And our political climate could use some of this. You're going to love your enemy. Here's another one. Here's what I'm going to do. And Jesus drops this F-bomb on people. He says, you need to forgive. Well, I don't want to do it. Well, that's radical and crazy. Yeah, that's what it is to go with me. You've got to let it go. You've got to forgive. He says, look, everybody on this earth has a problem, including you. So don't judge other people about their problems until you deal with your own problem. Oh, wow, that's crazy. Here's another one. We're going to live open-handed as followers of Jesus. That means everything that I have, I freely give. I give it to Jesus. I give to people in need. I give them my time. I give them my talent. I give them my money. That's how we're going to live. We're going to live. And if you will do that, you will take care of the needy. You will serve the needy. This is what it's going to be like. All right, this is what Jesus teaches. And we all say, I've been around churches, Clay. I've been around a lot of churches most of my life. I've been around a whole lot of Christians, and ain't a whole lot of Christians that do that. Right? I mean, I can't encounter a whole lot of Christians that do these types of things. And in fact, a lot of times they're doing the exact opposite of these things. And you can treat these things like they are optional if you want to. You can do that, but that is not following Jesus. And I think what we have done inside of the church and inside of Christianity in general is we have taken this stuff called Christianity, we've taken Jesus, and we have created a whole nother religion. And inside of that religion, we have this religious bubble that, if you just add Jesus to your life, you lose nothing, you sacrifice nothing, you risk nothing. And I'm here to tell you that's a false gospel. Because Jesus said, if you follow me, it'll cost you everything. Now, there's a lot more to gain, but it will cost you everything you have. And so you can have a community where you say, look, forgiving people is going to be optional. You can create a community like that. And you can create a community where you say, look, serving the needy, that's optional. Where being generous and just extremely generous, that's optional. You can create a community where, we're just going to judge people. You can do all these things. You can create that community if you want to. Just don't call it a church. Because that is not what Jesus taught. This is not optional thinking for us. And I know some of us, we kind of look at that and like, man, Clay, I am so sought out. I would want to be a part of a community like that. I have tried to be a part of a community like that. I have tried to love my enemy like that. I have tried to serve the needy. I have tried to live generous. I have tried to do that, and I just can't because I don't have it in me to do it. And you're exactly right. None of us in this space have it in us to do these things. And here's the secret. You just need to stop trying. There's another way. There's a better way to following the teachings of Jesus. And I want to explore that a little bit with you here because it is a driving force behind who we are as a church. And I want to give it to you in two questions. The first question that I want to ask you is, who's responsible? Who is responsible for spiritual growth? Who's responsible for your spiritual growth? You ever thought about that? Who's responsible for your spiritual growth? On your outline, I put it this way. You have to own your own spiritual life. You've got to own it. But you do not produce the spiritual transformation. Let me dive into this and break this down a little bit so it's not so confusing. You have to own your own spiritual life. What I mean by that is, if you are not growing spiritually, if you're here in this place and you call yourself a follower of Jesus and you're not growing spiritually, you can't blame me for that. You can't blame any other church for that. You can't blame your spouse for that. You can't blame your kids for that. You can't blame your job for that. You can't blame the busy season of life you're in for that. You cannot. You have to own it. That it is up to me to own my spiritual life. But it is not up to me to produce the spiritual transformation. Right? I own my spiritual life, but it is Jesus that produces the spiritual transformation. If I'm continually trying to do this and I'm trying to operate outside of Jesus and work hard, you're going to fail every time. Because it's not up to you to produce the transformation. Jesus says it this way in John chapter 15. He's real clear. He says, I am the vine. Okay? In other words, I'm the source. You're the branches. Those who remain in me, and these are important words, remain in me and I in them will produce much fruit. For apart from me, you will do, and what does the text say? You will do what? If you're here and saying, I'm just not making it, I'm just not growing, I think the answer is in this verse. See, our job is to just remain in Jesus, period. That's it. That's all we are asked to do, is to remain in Jesus. And the way that I said it in your notes is this. Your job, and we've said this many times before, your job is not to do wonderful things. Your job is to remain in Him. And the promise is, if you will remain in Him, if you will spend time with Jesus on a regular basis, you will do wonderful things. But if you try to reverse the process and you try to do wonderful things without remaining in Him, you're going to fail every time. You're going to fail every time. Some of you got bad habits. You want to break the bad habits. I just wish I could break that habit. You're so focused on the bad habit, you're never going to break it. Remain in Jesus. He'll take the desire away over time. I promise. It's happened to me 100 times. If you remain in Him, you will do wonderful things. You ever been around someone that just has an amazing God story, one after another? Like, wow, I can't believe all the stuff they're doing with God. That is amazing. That's amazing. You ever been around that person? I can tell you with 100% certainty, that person spends time with Jesus on a regular basis. That all they do is just remain in Jesus. Because if you will remain in Him, Jesus says, you will produce not a little bit of fruit, much fruit. There'll be amazing things that happen. My only job is to remain in Jesus, to abide in Him. So who's responsible for my spiritual growth? I've got to own it. It's up to Jesus to produce the transformation. I just need to remain in Him. So the second question that really needs to come up, how do you remain in Him? If that's my only job, how do you remain in Him? And here's where we get to this idea of something called spiritual disciplines. I actually like the term a little bit different, called spiritual habits. If you're going to remain in Jesus, you have to develop spiritual habits. And so, Chloe, what are spiritual habits? They are things that you do on a regular basis that draw you in closer to God. You say, well, prayer. Let's take prayer. Does praying on a regular basis, like spending time with God in prayer, does that allow me to remain in Jesus? Does that draw me closer to my Heavenly Father? Well, yes, it does. Does reading my Bible on a consistent basis and just being in the Word, does that draw me closer to Jesus? Yes, it does. Does fasting draw me closer to God? Yes, it does. Does being generous with my stuff and living open-handedly to say, God, whatever it is, I'm going to give back to you, and I'm going to make sure that I give. Does that draw me closer to God? Yes, because it makes you more dependent on God, right? Does going to the mountains or going to the beach and just reflecting on God's beauty draw me in to remain in Him, draw me closer to God? For me, yes, it does. Does watching the Falcons just pound on the Panthers draw me closer to Jesus? Yes, it does. I had to get that in there. Yeah, I guess I repent, Lord. Love your enemies. Love your enemies. So the question is, what do you have in your life that is drawing you to remain in Him? Do you have anything that you do as a habit on a regular basis? Jesus talks about this spiritual rhythm, that you need to have something in your life that is a rhythm, something that's regularly done. Matthew chapter 6. Jesus starts talking about private practices, things that you do in private. He says, watch out, don't do your good deeds publicly to be admired by others, for you will lose the reward from your Father in heaven. Now he goes on to talk about a very specific private thing, and he starts talking about giving. When you give to someone in need, don't do it like the hypocrites do, blowing trumpets in the synagogues and streets to call attention to their acts of charity. I tell you the truth, they have received all the reward they will ever get. But when you give to someone in need, don't let your left hand know what the right hand is doing. Give your gifts in private, and your Father who sees everything will reward you. What Jesus is talking about here is your private things. Don't do spiritual practices publicly in order to say, look how spiritual I am. You don't announce your giving to say, look how much I gave, look what I do, look how much we sacrifice. That's not the point. Take it into prayer. Is Jesus saying, well, don't pray in public? No, that's not what he's saying at all. He's saying when you sit down to say the blessing, don't try to think, how can I impress everybody with how spiritual I am with my blessing? He's like, no. Do these things privately. Do them because the Father is there. And there's a couple of interesting things here that I would love to point out, and that is that everything that you do privately, God sees it. So when you read your Bible and you're like, look, I'm going to go into this discipline and I'm going to read and I'm going to do everything I can to read and I don't really understand what's going on here, God sees that. And He's proud. When you pray and you're over praying, you're like, I don't know exactly how to pray, I don't know what to do, your Father sees you pray. When you forgive that person, when you're going through the process of loving your enemy, this says that God sees it, that no one else may see it, but God sees that. When you take those first steps into giving, and they're scary, and I get that they're scary, God sees that. But not only does He see it, the great thing about this, that last verse tells you, He rewards it. He rewards it. Now, specifically, Jesus chose as an example here, He talked about giving. And I think as a church, we have done giving a disservice. And we've actually misled a whole lot of people, probably selfishly done so that we could get more. And so when we would talk about giving, we would talk about giving to God like He was some Citibank cashback reward system. That if you'll just give God $5, you'll get $10 back in cash rewards. Right? And so a lot of times that is how giving was thought of. But let me explain to you that the reward here is not that. We way undersell God if we say that's what it's about. When I encounter people who have taken the step into what I call percentage giving, that just means that whatever they make, they take a percentage of that and they choose on purpose to give that on a regular basis. So every time they're paid, they give a percentage. Maybe if you grew up in church old school, it was like tithe and it's 10%. And I get some of you, the reason you grew up that and you don't even want to go, it's like, I can't give away 10%. Pick something less than that. Just start. Just start. But any time that I see someone step into percentage giving, what I see over and over, and I've seen this in my wife's life, mine and my wife's life, our entire married life, we had always given a large percentage of our income, and we're well beyond 10% now. And what happens is that money loses its grip. Loses its grip. Like, money does not control those people. You ever been on a diet? Like, I've been dieting for the last 6 months and working really hard to gain back some control. And I was talking with someone in the first service. They had Krispy Kreme donuts out. And before, this time last year, that was like kryptonite. I can't, it's like Lay's potato chips. I couldn't eat just one, right? And it was like sugary things and cakey and bready things. They just controlled me, and it just had me in a grip. But now, I can look at that, and it doesn't have a hold on me. You ever experienced that? The way that you get rid of the grip of money is you throw some gifts in there. And when you give and give and give and give, money loses its grip on you. Loses its grip. And the reward that your Father gives you is peace. See, more money never equals peace. You could make more money tomorrow. It will not bring peace. It will bring more stress. Studies have shown more money always brings more stress. But when you invite God in, this is what Jesus is trying to show us, when you invite God in, the reward you get is peace. It doesn't control me. God's in control. And I have peace. Now, we can move off of money because I've made some of you really uncomfortable. Let's pick another discipline. Prayer. You see, when we pray, and we do it privately, there's a change and there's a reward that comes from prayer as well. Dylan's story, when he lost his dad, anger had overtaken him. And in his story, he has to deal with it. And he finds a private way to pray, and I want you to listen for the reward that comes at the end of this. Let's watch the rest of Dylan's story.
It was draining on my soul, just not being able to think about anything else but the loss. From the outside looking in, you wouldn't be able to tell. You'd see Dylan, and of course, yeah, he was dealing with some stuff, and he was sad, but he was still Dylan. He was still had a smile on his face. But behind closed doors, it was consuming me. There were times where I would be headed to school. I would just pull into a parking lot and just weep. Just being so angry with the situation. I remember one day, I just walk into the room and I said, "Mom, can you please just buy me a punching bag? I am just so angry all the time." She said, "That's fine, son. I'll buy you a punching bag. But there's something that I want you to do as well." She said, "I want you to begin to ask the Lord to heal your heart. When you become consumed with that anger, or when you feel that anger starting to creep up on you, I want you to just say, 'Lord, just heal my heart. Just heal my heart. Lord, heal my heart.'" So I began to do that. It was just not knowing how else to feel better. And just saying, "Well, I'll give God a chance to make this better." Even when I was angry, and even when I was sad and was just a mess, just asking him, "Lord, heal my heart. Heal my heart," even if it wasn't doing anything right then. You know, it wasn't like I just went to church. I saw a service, and then I walked out of there, and I was like, "Whoa, all right, I'm just normal again." Never happened. It was a journey that took time and consistency, walking out that prayer and walking out my relationship with God, just leaning on Him. One day I just kind of looked back and was just like, and just thought, "Whoa, like, I am no longer angry," or the pain is gone. I was free to live a more peaceful life, a healed life. If you're in a place where you're feeling the same way that I felt, reach out to God. Let him know how you feel. Share with him what you're going through. His heart is for your heart to be healed and for you to live and walk in freedom. Ask him to do it, and he will heal your heart.
Did you hear it in there? It was a journey. It took time and consistency. Basically, what Dylan is saying is he had to remain in him. That as he remained in him during that prayer time and hitting a punching bag for him and just saying, God, heal my heart, that was prayer. That his job was not to produce the wonderful things and fix himself. His job was just to remain in him. And the reward was a healed heart. The reward, did you catch that? Was peace. You see, what the Father sees you do in private, he will reward. But we have to remain in him. That's our only job. And some of you here, this is new news for you. Maybe this is groundbreaking news for you. I would challenge all of us to just remain in Jesus. We're going to sing a song here as we wrap up. And what I want you to do during this song is I want you to close your eyes. You don't even need to sing through the first part. I don't want you to sing. And as our band sings the song, I just want you to ask, Holy Spirit, show me where I'm really at. Put a mirror in front of me. Where am I at? And I want you to let him speak to you as you say, okay, then I'm just going to remain in you. That's my only job. Jesus, right now, I pray that you would speak to us. Holy Spirit, come into this room. That our one desire would be to just be with you. Lord, see our hearts. Begin that process with us. Lord, begin to set us free.